You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 18th of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
Colin Powell, former US Secretary of State and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, dies at 84. China posts less than usually stellar economic indicators. And if you like the book, does it matter who wrote it? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Isabel Hilton and Kapil Komareddy, will discuss all the day's big stories and reflect on the life and career of the late Colin Powell.
I've always felt strongly that you should try to solve conflicts in this world through negotiations, through diplomacy. Anytime we can solve a problem that way and not use force and satisfy our objectives, let's push for that.
Stay tuned. That's all coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by the founder of China Dialogue, Isabel Hilton, and by the writer and author of Malevolent Republic, A Short History of the New India, Kapil Komareddy. Hello to you both. I feel like, actually, damn it, we're going to do it. Let's carry on the gloating about Monocle 24's 10th anniversary for another week at least. Isabel, haven't seen you since our party on Thursday night. How did you recover?
What a memorable party it was, Andrew.
Yes, it was very jolly. We do a good one.
You do a good one. And yeah, I particularly enjoyed your contribution, of course.
Thank you.
And the booze was pretty good. It wasn't bad.
I should, getting over it. I should stress to listeners that when Isabel refers to my contribution, you are doubtless recalling the live edition of The Daily, which was an extremely sober and well-run piece of impromptu broadcasting. And I want to make it clear there was not any dancing on the tables related shenanigans, at least not by me. Certain of my colleagues cannot claim the same. Kapil, you were not there. We could not help but notice. It was all anybody talked about.
Yes, forgive me for that. But I was working and I thought it was next week. And I only realised it was on Thursday after arriving at the studio.
I'll see if we can put together another massive party solely in your honour next Thursday. We could do one of these every week for different ones of our guests. That'll keep us going until the 11th anniversary. Let us, however, start with today's big story, which is the United States mourning the passing of General Colin Powell, former Secretary of State and former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the first Black American to hold either office. He was 84 years old and died of complications associated with COVID-19. He had been suffering from multiple myeloma, a cancer of plasma cells which impedes immune response. Monocle spoke to Colin Powell just a few weeks ago. In this clip, he discusses the importance of education and the work he was doing with young people at his School for Civic and Global Leadership in New York City.
I also do a lot of work for undergraduates and early grades because I want to get them ready for the Colin Powell School or any other school they're going to go to at the higher level of education. And those that get into the Colin Powell School or into CCNY or into most of the universities of America, we've got to prepare them. And they got to be prepared. And it's not just waiting until they're 18 years old and someone, you know, gives them an education they haven't had. It's got to start at the very beginning of their life. It has to start in the home. It has to start with the family. But Powell, suppose they don't have a good home. Suppose there isn't a real family. There may be one person left in that family. What does that mean? It means they're in trouble. It means that we then have to come in with other kinds of programs, boys and girls clubs, similar organizations that will enter the life of these youngsters and persuade them that they have to study, they have to learn, they have to behave themselves. We can't afford for them to get in trouble. We can't afford for you youngsters to get in trouble. We need you. And we've got to put that into their mind and their soul so that they will be ready by the time they're old enough to go to college. In my case, I entered college when I was 16, 16 and a half. And I had all of this. Where did I get it from? My church, my Anglican church. I got it from the public library that I went to regularly. I got it from my relatives, my Jamaican relatives mostly. and my parents, my two parents. And they made it clear, you know, that we believe in you, we believe in this country, and we expect you to do your very, very best. Don't shame this family. It's the one they used to drill into us all the time. You know, do your very, very best, and whatever you do, never shame this family. My sister went ahead of me, and she became a teacher, but she left enough experience behind for me to realize I had to do my very, very best. And whenever I did get in trouble, and this was something I was able to do on a regular basis, I had one rule among a couple of others, but the big one was, don't shame your family. And the one who would know that first is my mom and my dad. And all beyond that, my West Indian relatives, my aunts and uncles, who were mostly in New York now, they watched me out of the window every day. It was an aunt looking for me. And if I ever got in trouble, I was turned to my parents. And so I knew that I was expected to behave this way. I had a school system, a public school system that did it. And I had other facilities like the library, like my churches, the two churches we attended. And I just stayed the course. And then finally, when I was 16 and a half, I graduated, entered college at just short of 17. I just, you know, didn't do that well my first semester in school. But in the second semester, I discovered the military program, ROTC, and that was all it took, because I had sergeants and officers now who were making sure that I knew what the Army required, and I had to give it to them. Do you have any questions, Mr. Powell? No, sir. And that's what I did for the next 4 years. And then I graduated at the top of my class in the Army, my group. As soon as I graduated from CCNY, I immediately entered the Army, and I had to compete with folks from Harvard, from Yale, from every other school you can think of that's in the principal group of schools in our college system. And I had to go compete with them. But I was able to. I did well. And I was successful in college. And then I got into the Army. I did well there. And they ran out of things to give me in the Army. So I quit when I became chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That was the end of it.
That was the late Colin Powell speaking to Monocle just a few weeks ago. Kapil, you enjoyed the distinction at this table of having actually spoken to him.
Yes, I had a very brief conversation with him on the telephone some years ago.
It's not much, but we'll take it.
I rang his phone. I spoke to him, tried to interview him. He was very polite to me. He said to me he was withholding comment on the subject I wanted to discuss with him at the time, but he nonetheless gave me the name of the person I needed to talk to, and he said, I'll put in a word and I'll ask her to, you know, expedite your request. So he was very polite to me.
Okay, well, polite, that's something. We've learned that. Isabel, how significant a figure was he? I mean, obviously, that's a slightly idle question to ask about somebody who was Secretary of State and former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, but there has always been this idea around Colin Powell that all that notwithstanding, he kind of underachieved. There were suggestions that he might run for president in 1996 or 2000.
There were, but he didn't actually show very much interest or indeed aptitude, I suspect, for a political career. And, you know, to be the first African-American to get where he got is already a pretty significant achievement.
Indeed so.
It's interesting the role that ROTC played, where he was talking in that, I thought, rather appealing interview that you just played. Because when he was in college, the whole program of having ROTC on campus was very much a target of the student movement, which was the anti-Vietnam War movement. And people were trying to get it off campus because the military were very unpopular. So it's interesting thinking in that context of what it obviously did a lot of good to him, and he was able to find his place in the military very quickly. I think, though, that he'll be remembered for something that, you know, now we look at and we wonder, well, what became of that, which was the Powell Doctrine.
Mm.
And those were the rules that he drew up for, you know, what questions that had to be answered before the United States would go to war. And given the role he played in leading the United States into the Iraq War and that notorious speech that he gave at the UN, it's worth just looking at what he really thought earlier in his career. Is a vital national security interest threatened? Do we have a clear attainable objective? Have the risks and costs been fully analysed? Have all other non-violent policy means been fully exhausted? Is there a plausible exit strategy? Have the consequences been fully considered? Are we supported by the American people? And do we have genuine broad international support? Almost none of those was true for the Iraq War. And yet he, you know, this very decent man, I think, and I think a man who had a reputation for honesty and humanity, allowed himself to be used in that UN speech to try to swing the international community behind the invasion of Iraq.
It is a strange contradiction, because the Powell Doctrine, Kapil, while comprehensive enough, could also be interpreted, and indeed has been by some critics, as a mandate for inaction. I mean, it's hard to imagine circumstances in which you would get a yes to all eight of those questions. But that speech in particular to the UN in 2003, as Secretary of State, making the George W. Bush's administration's case for invading Iraq. He later referred to it as a blot on his record. He was clearly embarrassed by it. But there is the question, I think, which hangs over an official in that position. What is the right thing to do? Which I guess was addressed by officials in a more recent American administration as well. Is the right thing to do to publicly say, this is madness, I want no part of this, I'm out? Or do you try to be, I guess, as he might have seen it, a good soldier, do what you're told, and yet try to influence the inevitable from within?
I think I'm not going to advance an extenuation for his personal responsibility in selling the wars that continue to blight us today. But I think the reason he allowed himself to become a pawn for the Bush administration bespeaks his own character. I think the arc of Colin Powell's life, he's born in the 1930s and he becomes the first black Secretary of State in the 2000s. I think if you study his life, he realizes, and it comes through in the clip you played earlier, faith, family, responsibility, discipline, these are the things that made him who he was. And he brought that sense of discipline to his role. And while he dissented from the government very strongly in discussions, internal discussions, when the decision had been made, he did what a good soldier does. He went out and he made the argument. Obviously, he regretted that profoundly. And much of his post-governmental career was a form of atonement for that. In 2008, he didn't endorse John McCain, one of the great champions of intervention, and he chose to endorse Barack Obama. And towards the end of his life, he effectively broke away from the Republican Party, having announced in 95 that he was a Republican. And part of the reason he declared himself a Republican was, again, the values, faith, family, discipline. And he saw the Republican Party becoming something else entirely. But I think the role he played in selling the Iraq War, without in any way offering an extenuation for his choices, I think was animated in great part by the soldierly discipline he had picked up in the military.
Well, let's move along now and look at China. There are a great many countries which would be delighted by quarterly GDP growth of 4.9%, but China and those who invest in it are accustomed to better. The newly published figure is relatively sluggish for the People's Republic, down from 7.9% in the previous quarter, and is being linked to plagues of power outages, fraying supply chains, recurrent COVID-19 outbreaks, and a gathering sense that China's property sector might be quite the house of cards. New construction starts in September were down 13.5% year on year. Isabel, before we get into what these figures mean, the question that I know I ask you every single time we talk about Chinese economic figures, which is, would you bet your house on these?
I think certainly the trend is reliable, even if the, you know, if a close examination might reveal that one or two needed to be corrected later by the ever patient National Audit Office, who spend their lives doing this. But I think what matters here is the trend and the fact that it's below the predicted 6%.
But just to follow that up, Isabel, how big a thing is that? If we look at how the Hang Seng Index in Hong Kong reacted, it was briefly down a bit and then up a bit.
Sure. I, you know, it's not that the economy is going to collapse, But, you know, the point you made about the property sector is extremely important, because this isn't just a little blip in this quarter. You know, the Evergrande situation, which is pretty dire, signals the end of a system that has been used to stimulate, often increasingly artificially, the GDP figures. And that is that local authorities nationalize land, they confiscate land, they rezone it, they borrow largely, and they build apartment blocks. Now, this has resulted in a number of things which are hanging over the Chinese economy: a very large internal debt, a lot of very empty apartment blocks, some of which have been blown up lately because they couldn't be finished, and massive property companies that are teetering on the edge of collapse. Now, even if they don't collapse, even if this is not a Lehman Brothers moment, and it may well not be, but it still means that that particular model is bust. And that model has been responsible for about 40% of economic activity in China in the last few years. And if the local governments don't have that to prop up their budgets, what do they have? So you have a whole series of problems which are bundled up in the property situation, and indeed in these lower than expected figures. And you just, you know, there's kind of trouble everywhere you look in the Chinese economy at the moment.
Kapil, Isabel has there raised some fearsome spectres, from those of us at least who can remember back to 2008 and what happens when it turns out that the property market of an economic superpower has been hilariously overvalued. Is there actually a concern of something like that occurring in China?
I think that there very much is. 29% of China's GDP is property-based, and Evergrande alone has 1.6 million undelivered apartments. There are 65 million unoccupied homes. That's the entire population of France can be housed in the empty houses in China.
A country with a falling population, by the way.
With a falling population. So that is, if there is a bubble, that's a bubble. And that, as Isabel has pointed out, is about to burst. And the fallout of that, would it be contained within China, or would it go beyond? It depends upon, I think, the response of the government. Right now, the government, I understand, is very reluctant to bail out Evergrande. So Evergrande has the largest debt of any company. And what the government is doing is it's pressuring state-affiliated corporations to buy up its debt rather than interfere directly. And we'll figure out, I think, the picture will emerge in the coming weeks whether China faces its Lehman Brothers moment or not. But either way, consumer confidence has dipped. And I think we're already seeing the crisis manifest itself in the form of power cuts, in the form of, you know, people moving their money out of China. So we are going to, I think this sort of the feeling that China is the ultimate hegemon, that, you know, it is the next, somebody described it to me as the future. We are here. This is the future. I think we'll have to hold our breath on that for a moment.
Isabel, if this isn't panic stations yet, and the markets so far don't appear to believe that it is, what would panic stations actually be, and how might the Chinese Communist Party react to whatever their equivalent of a Lehman Brothers moment is?
Well, I suppose panic stations would be if Evergrande actually did go bust and triggered a kind of cascade of similar bankruptcies of other property companies, and that might bring down, you know, a major financial institution. That's what the government is trying to avoid. The other thing it's trying to avoid is a lot of very angry people, because, you know, there are limited numbers of things that you can invest in China, and the great middle classes of China have, to a great extent, invested in property. And I know people, the perfectly ordinary people, who own three or four properties. They live in one, the others are just parking their money. They're not even occupied. Now, once those prices start falling, those people are going to get angry. The other people are going to be angry are the people who've actually paid for their Evergrande property, because Evergrande ran out of credit. So it was asking punters to pay for their apartments before they were built. And they're going to be very angry because, you know, where's their apartment? So there are the government will be trying to deal with the little people, look after them so that they don't get riots and, you know, people trying to burn down the party headquarters of you know, Zhejiang province or whatever. They'll let the foreign investors take the hit, for sure. I wouldn't, if I was holding a bond for Evergrande and I, you know, was not Chinese, I would I'd probably, you know, paper the bathroom with it. You're not going to get your money. And they're going to try and sort of, you know, manage their way through it.
Isabel Hilton and Kapil Komareddy, thank you both for the moment. We will have more from our panel shortly. This is The Daily.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. The world is a better place when people have more courage than fear, especially in uncertain times. People seek stability and confidence. By supporting each other and sharing resources across the world, Allianz has helped people to overcome their fears and look to the future with hope and with real confidence. Marie Doha Besancenot is the Brand and Communication Director of Allianz France. Marie Doha Besancenot, it's great to talk with you. How does Allianz support entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship?
When I was first interviewed by my CEO for a position at Allianz France, he told me, if you take the job, your work will be all about innovation and startups. And I thought he was just trying to sell me the job. And after years with the company, I really confirmed that innovation and entrepreneurship are really core interests and core values for Allianz. So we support entrepreneurship in many ways, but I would say in four main ways. First is investing in startups, partnering with them, accelerating them, and then developing intrapreneurship, so inside the company. So at Allianz France, we're very present in the startup ecosystem, and basically we do everything with them, accelerate them, partner with them, invest in them. The most visible asset is a startup accelerator we have in Nice, inside the Allianz Riviera Stadium. Since 2015, we accelerated over 50 of them. The second way we support startups is invest in them. So we decided to create a corporate venture capital fund. Allianz Group has Allianz X, which famously invested in companies like Lemonade and Gotcheck. At Allianz France, we have Innov Allianz. Our aim is to support French startups who transform the insurance market. And so since 2016, we've invested $40 million in 20 companies like October, Cityscoot, or Ornicar. So they are French leaders on equity loan, free-floating scooters, and driving schools. And interestingly, 60% of the amount we invested in these funds actually led to partnerships with these companies. And this is the third lever we have to support entrepreneurship, partnering with startups.
Marie Doha Besancenot, Brand and Communication Director of Allianz France, on unlocking, building and maintaining confidence today and tomorrow. With Allianz, you can take confidence in tomorrow. Allianz, behind you for what's ahead.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests Isabel Hilton and Kapil Komareddy. Sticking with China, it increasingly seems that President Xi Jinping will not be finding the time to attend next month's COP26 climate change conference in Glasgow. It is possible that he is engaged in an amount of the kind of bluffing designed to keep everyone else in a state of suggestible agitation, and he's not alone in being slow to send his RSVP. But China is, and by some margin, the world's leading source of fossil fuel CO2 emissions, and as such, it is tough to imagine a meaningful climate agreement in which China, and certainly China's paramount leader, is not included. Isabel, it's not just that he might not be coming to Glasgow, it's that he hasn't been going anywhere. He didn't go to the UN General Assembly, for example. He hasn't been anywhere at all since January 2020. And while I do know the feeling, I'm not actually the president of China. Nobody much cares in my case.
He's a stellar example of working from home at this point. he didn't even go to Kunming, which is inside China.
It wouldn't have killed him, you wouldn't have thought.
You wouldn't have thought so. And there was quite a big event there, which was the opening of COP15, the biodiversity conference, which China is hosting. But he sent a message by video, and I suspect we'll get another video message this time round. Who will be there, however, is Xie Zhenhua. The poor man keeps trying to retire. He's known as China's veteran climate negotiator for good reason. You know, he's been through every climate wars that we've seen, and he's very close to John Kerry. So they're a good team. And that is certainly, you know, where some action will be. It's a pity Xi Jinping isn't coming, but it's not the end of the world.
Well, that's exactly the point of the conference, ideally. Kapil, it has been said by those who are optimistic that China does take this seriously out of self-interest, if nothing else, that it understands that it's not good when the air in some of its cities is literally unbreathable, and also that it understands that there are colossal opportunities in cleaning the planet up. And whoever does actually figure that one out is going to be a mighty wealthy country indeed. And certainly there's no doubt that China has all the expertise and resources you could possibly want to be that country. But do we think yet that China takes this seriously enough?
There are a couple of things there. My not coming to the Monocle Party went unnoticed, but President Xi not turning up at COP26.
You do yourself a disservice. It was all people spoke of.
President Xi not turning up at COP26 devalues the summit. China consumes half of the world's coal. China is accelerating fuel production. It produces, I think, 1,000 gigawatts of electricity using coal power. To put that in context, Britain's entire electricity generating capacity is 75 gigawatts. For President Xi to skip this means that the head of state of China, the most powerful head of state in China, is not going to be at the summit that is meant to save this planet from extinction. So that's not very promising. Number two, why isn't President Xi going? Part of the reason, there's one thing, which is that perhaps they're trying to use climate change as a leverage, because his foreign minister, Wang Yi, said that climate change cannot be separated from US-China relations. So in return for China's cooperation on climate change, perhaps they want concessions on other matters. That is one aspect of it. The second aspect of it is perhaps President Xi is actually afraid of a coup when he's away. There have been multiple attempts, and there's been a lot of talk in 2017. People were purged, and his consolidation, although accelerated and rapid, isn't complete. And to some extent, I think the fact that he hasn't left the country in 2 years suggests that there is some element of fear there, that maybe that accounts for the fact that he's not going anywhere.
Well, further to that, Isabel, and let's do a bit of good old-fashioned, whatever the Chinese equivalent of Kremlinology is there something to that? Like, is there something up with President Xi not wishing to travel beyond him being, I don't know, a bit wary of COVID-19 or whatever the excuse being advanced is? Because it is starting to get a bit odd at this point.
It is certainly noticeable. I would say that Wang Yi does not make China's climate policy. Wang Yi is, you know, just heeding the clarion call of, you know, let's be wolf warrior diplomacies. That's the Chinese foreign minister. But fortunately, he has remarkably little influence in state policy and certainly in domestic mitigation, which is where China's action really counts. As far as Xi Jinping not leaving China, I think there are a lot of sort of ripples and eddies in the water at the moment. For one thing, he continues to purge the security forces, which is pretty striking 10 years into, you know, and it's been a 10-year purge, essentially. I think he's probably, I don't know if he's worried about a coup or not, but I'm sure he's thinking very hard about the 20th Party Congress next year, which is the moment when we discover whether he does keep his job for life or not. And that, I'm sure, is contested within the party. And I'm sure he's doing an awful lot of management of that kind of thing, because he's set up a situation in which Chinese politics have reverted to a zero-sum game. And if you lose, you really lose. And that's partly his doing, largely his doing.
Final quick thought on this one, Kapil, because we will doubtless be returning to COP26 fairly frequently in the coming weeks. But how broadly optimistic are you personally that this is going to solve anything?
Really, I'm not optimistic at all, primarily because we've seen this in 97, 2007, 2010, 2011, 2015. The big problem with this is governments are colossal bodies. And when their representatives agree to do something, they have to go back and persuade their legislatures. In the case of a country such as India, for instance, they'd have to persuade 28 state governments to take this on, and the bureaucrats have to implement it. It's a very long process. And I think it's time for us to acknowledge that for all the good this may do, we have reached a stage where these summits are not going to solve much.
Well, on that cheerful thought, we will move finally along to what seems like a relatively footling literary semi-scandal in Spain, though it does also feel like a metaphor for something or other. Let's see if we can figure out what. The Planeta Prize, awarded annually to an outstanding Spanish language novel, is well worth winning. Nigh certainly the world's most valuable one-off literary gong, accompanied as it is by a check for €1 million. It was awarded this year to the thriller writer Carmen Mola, who turned up to collect the award bearing a striking resemblance to three middle-aged men, Jorge Diaz, Antonio Macero, and Augustin Martinez, who had been collaborating behind a female pseudonym. Isabel, this is quite, I don't know, this is weird on so many levels. Are you especially scandalized by this?
I'm absolutely vastly amused by this, to be honest, because I think it plays into a lot of things which I've been finding increasingly irritating, which is, you know, a world in which, you know, if you don't live it, you can't write about it. So, you know, if we apply that kind of strictures to the previous literary efforts, Shakespeare would have written plays entirely about a man of whatever age he was at the time, you know, not experiencing anything particular. So I think that the whole question of identity has gone too far. I think it's hilarious that they got away with it, and I wonder how much the idea that it was Carmen Mola was, you know, instrumental in putting them up for the prize in the first place.
Because we should stress that it wasn't just that they wrote the books under that name; they created an entire persona around it. They gave interviews
they
by
did.
Email.
The whole thing was fake. But you know, we live in a world in which politicians lie about things that are far more important. So, you know, I think it's a wonderful tease.
Kapil, there is a fairly fundamental question here that it does pose, which is the one about the relationship between the art and the artist. Does it make a difference to your enjoyment of the thing if it turns out that it wasn't quite created by who you thought had created it or how you thought they had created it? Do you still listen to your Milli Vanilli records?
I started reading a novel by Ismail Kadari, a novelist I admire enormously, and I was oddly disappointed. If I'd picked up that book not knowing who the author was, I probably would have liked it very much, because my expectations were driven very high by the knowledge that this is a writer I respected enormously. With this particular novel, though, I agree entirely with Isabel, and I'm equally amused. The problem here seems to me to be that it was a marketing ploy. Mm. They did it primarily to sell books, right? And a lot of people are interpreting this as an identity problem. They just created a persona to sell books. You know, the idea of a middle-aged school teacher writing these crime novels just drove the book sales. You wrote a fine book recently, and
copies still readily available.
If you'd marketed the book as the work of a writer from southern India writing about sport in Australia, I think it would have you know, had a market in India.
We should swap literary personas. your indictment of Narendra Modi's India, which I'm sure is also still freely available, might have cleaned up massively in India if people had thought I'd written it.
Exactly. But I'm not at all scandalised by it, and I agree
entirely. I'm not sure which of us would have got more hate mail, mind you.
But it doesn't matter matter if it's fiction, but I think that there are occasions in which it does matter if the author misrepresents him or herself, and that's in the realm of autobiography, for example. I think it does matter because the assumption is and the compact is that you're reading about somebody's life. There was a notorious case of a book called The Third Eye. Have you ever read it? Published in the 1950s. The opening line is, "I am a Tibetan Lama." Turned out this was a man called Cyril who lived in Devon, who was the son of a plumber. But it was a massive bestseller.
Kapil, I notice you still haven't answered the question about whether or not you still listen to your Milli Vanilli records.
I don't.
Were you disappointed then to discover that that whole thing had been an imposture?
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, okay. Well, sorry, I'll tell you the truth about Santa Claus after we're done here as well. But Isabel, this was something I wondered about at the time, because Milli Vanilli, who people may recall from having made some extremely bad pop records some while ago, sold millions of albums and won a Grammy. And yet it was eventually revealed that the two chaps said to have sung on those records had not, in fact, sung on them. And people got really angry. And I was really baffled by that, because mostly because I thought, like, this is what upsets you about the Milli Vanilli records, as opposed to the obvious manifest dreadfulness of them. But genuinely, I thought, like, you enjoyed the records. Why is it a problem who sang on them?
Yeah, I can't see what the problem would be. After all, for years we watched musicals in which we know that at least one of the stars had been dubbed because they don't sing very well, and you know that didn't seem to be a huge problem. So you know, if the experience is pleasant, what's wrong with it?
And Kapil, just as a final thought on this, have you ever been disappointed by any discovery of inauthenticity as such?
Oh, difficult question. I can't say I have. No, I've really enjoyed some authors and I've had high expectations of them. Sometimes you discover that a writer has, say, plagiarized work. There's an element of disappointment there, but the identity aspect of it, you know, an anonymous writer writing about it. I was thinking about the novel, Joe Klein wrote a novel called Primary Colors about Bill
Under
Clinton.
Under the name Anonymous, yes.
And it became a bestseller because a number of people thought some Clinton insider had written it, you know, one of his closest advisors. And after it became a bestseller and was made into a film, Joe Klein, who was a writer of Time magazine, came out and said, I wrote it, but it would have been equally enjoyable as a novel. Part of the reason I think people bought it was because they thought the observations were very accurate, and they revealed the true Clinton, and the person writing it had access to him. So that kind of representation perhaps is a marketing ploy. But as a reader, I think it depends upon the quality of the work. You were just talking about the records. If a song is good, you know, A Rose by Any Other Name would smell as sweet. Well, that was Shakespeare, but we don't know if it was.
Well, on that highfalutin note, Kapil Komaredi and Isabel Hilton, who I assure our listeners are real people who are right here in the studio. They are not being impersonated by anybody else. Thank you both. That is all for this edition of The Daily. The show was produced by Marcus Hippie and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.